Air travel in the U.S. has been shaken by a series of major disasters in early 2025. What's being done to ensure safety in the skies? U.S. Secretary of Transportation Sean Duffy will tell us. And a U.S. Archbishop plans to reconsecrate his state to Christ in response to satanic attacks. Archbishop Joseph Nauman of Kansas City, Kansas, is here with details. And the Vatican issues a new photo of Pope Francis. What does it really show? Father Gerald Murray joins me with analysis. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond DeRoy.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you this evening. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo. I'm also on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show. He is a husband, a father of nine, and a former U.S. congressman and TV anchor who on January 28th was sworn in as the 20th Secretary of the U.S. Department of Transportation. We sat down at his offices to discuss the many transportation challenges facing the country, including air travel, rail, and highway infrastructure, as well as the future of DEI. Here's my interview with Secretary Sean Duffy. Secretary Duffy, thank you so much for the time. I have to start with, when you first came in, there were these series of tragic air accidents at Reagan Airport. You had the military helicopter hitting that American Airlines flight. Then in Philadelphia, you had a private plane go down. What did you think, having just been sworn in, suddenly you have to deal with these encroaching disasters?
Well, it was not the way we anticipated our tenure starting out. But again, it what it did, Raymond, is it put in focus the mission of the department is safety, right? And I talked to a number of the families from the DCA crash who lost loved ones. And if you can prevent that, if you can have policies in place that save future lives, I'm going to do everything I can to make that happen. And so with DCA, again, that was really day number one for me. And again, we had 85 incidents in the last 3 years where we had really, really close calls between helicopters and fixed-wing aircraft. The FAA should have known. We should have seen those stats, seen
those
numbers.
Why did it take so long for the FAA to ban? You have banned the military aircraft operating within the sphere of Reagan Airport.
Right.
Why did it take so long to figure
that
out?
It was a crash, right, that did that. But the FAA could have seen the data before, right? And sometimes it's easy to look back and see data as opposed to looking forward. We're using AI tools to analyze the data and see other hot spots in the country to make sure that we don't miss anything, you know, moving forward. But again, I think you had pilot air. Pilots are supposed to stay away, see landing aircraft, stay away from landing aircraft. They didn't in this situation. Obviously, we had an air incident. But just to be clear, we're going to allow the president to obviously fly through that airspace. If there's a life-saving mission or a law enforcement mission, they can fly through the airspace. But if that happens, we shut down air travel. You do not have helicopters and landing airplanes together again crossing paths. No more DCA.
The other day at LaGuardia, a plane was taking off and the wing scraped the tarmac. We've had four of these major incidents of aircraft and assorted other ones, the crash landing in Toronto and other things. How do you reassure people that air travel remains safe? I know there weren't as many crashes or incidents as there were in the last year before you came to office, but how do you reassure
them? Well, the media follows this now after DCA,
yeah.
Right? And you lose 67 souls. They should focus on it. But air travel is the safest mode of transportation. The most dangerous part of your travel is from your home to the airport, not, you know, from the airplane from destination A to destination B. So that's key. But what's also important is it's made us look at the system as a whole. How does the air traffic control work? What systems do we use? How old is it? And it's been a call to say, listen, this is 25 and 30 years old. Let's fix it. Let's fix the system before we lose lives because we have such an old system. We're not. What we're seeing is, I think, we're seeing a lot of pilot error, right? We're seeing mistakes by pilots. They got to refocus. Yeah. They got to pay attention to safety. Again, everyone around you, on your plane, but also at the airport, other aircraft, all of them have a trust that everyone puts a premium on safety, and we have to remind them of how important their roles are.
Tell me about the FAA. What is happening at the FAA? You, I know, have spoken out. There was this story, I remember we covered this years ago, where a union head of I'll read you the name, the head of the National Black Coalition of Federal Aviation, he leaked answers to African-American candidates for air traffic control jobs. So it was kind of a DEI fix that was in. You said you're going to investigate that. What else do you plan to do?
So there was a DEI effort under the Obama era. Yeah. The Congress saw that. They snuffed it out, right? But there's been a lot of stories that have come up making accusations that DEI still exists at air traffic control. And so we said, listen, we're going to do an investigation to give us the information about, are we actually getting the best and the brightest, or is there other factors in play? Because, you know, when I'm flying or you're flying or our kids are flying through airspace, I want the best air traffic controller. I want the best pilot. I don't want you to hire for anything but the best and the brightest. And if you're bringing people in for other factors, you have no place. Maybe at a university, which I'd object to that too, but if a university doesn't take lives.
Yeah.
But air traffic controllers and pilots, this is critical. And so we've said, not at all. Best and brightest, that's it.
Lives hang in the balance.
That's right.
Every day. You were just at Boeing, I saw. The other day, the aviation manufacturer, there's a cap, there's a federal cap at 38 planes per month of those 737 MAXs after a series of disasters. Let's face it, the doors flying off, bolts not properly attached. What assurances have they given you that this will get better? And what is the federal government doing to check the current fleet that I flew here on?
So, listen, as I went there, when you take down the number of planes they can produce a month, it makes them focus on safety in the planes that they do produce. When you slow it down. But over COVID, they lost a lot of great experienced people who did the manufacturing at Boeing. And so they're bringing in new people, and they have to train them up. And so by the slowdown, I think they're going to get to the place where they're going to be able to expand that production. But right now, I feel pretty good about the numbers that they can produce. Again, this is a great company. It did lose its way, and they were focused on the bottom line and quarterly profits as opposed to engineering and technology and machinists building airplanes. They're getting back to that, but again, it's a cultural change they have to make.
Yeah.
And they've started, and when they get to the point where we feel like they can go to the next level, we'll allow them. Yeah. They're not there yet.
You've been running all over the country. I saw you the other day at Amazon. You were at the Amazon Air, Prime Air. They're launching these drones all over the country to deliver goods. I mean, you call them up, here comes the drone. The FAA is petitioning to allow more drones in the airspace. Sean Duffy, why should we do that? The airspace is already congested. It doesn't seem we can handle or control the airspace we oversee now. Why do you want drones flying through?
Raymond, come on. You're going to get your package, you know, within 30 minutes. The drones are safe.
But I don't want it hitting my aircraft as I land.
No. So there'll be, there are blackout zones around airports.
Okay.
Again, they fly at no higher than 400 feet. So when we allow, the FAA allows drones to fly, they're going to fly in areas where it's safe. We don't have 747s coming in. We don't have Cessnas coming in. They're lower to the ground. But again, we want to make sure that they're fully tested and they're going to be safe. But it's not just a safety component. People are concerned about the noise factor of these drones. And there'll be a lot of room for communities to decide, do you want Amazon Prime to come in? What does the community say? If they say yes, let's let them come in. But to think that, just think about this for a second. Nice. We have a revolution. This is my cell phone. It's cracked. But this changed the way we live.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
I can book flights here. I can bank from here. I do social media with you from here.
Yeah.
It revolutionized. We're going to revolutionize air travel in America, how people and products move, whether it's autonomous vehicles, these eVTOLs or Uber in the air, and drone technology.
Do you have controls of those robots we see running through cities?
Is that under
your dominion?
No.
No?
Those
rolling robots?
If they're on our public streets,
our
federally funded streets, yes.
Yeah.
But a lot of that is being dictated by the communities that are allowing for those to roll out.
Traverse their neighborhoods, yeah.
But we're going to change the way we move and the way products move. And it's going to make it more efficient. It's going to make it faster. But the key is, if we don't have rules and regulations in place that allow the innovators to innovate here and test here, and then once they get approvals to build their products here, they're going to China, they're going to go to India, they're going to go to somewhere else. Yeah. And we lose the technology, we lose the innovators, and we lose the manufacturing. So these are future jobs and future technology that we want to keep in America. And that's why our role is to make sure the rules keep people safe, but allow them to continue to advance in the technology.
And innovation. We remain on the forefront of the innovation.
That's right.
Before I move on, and I want to talk to you about policy in a second, a pet peeve. Should the FAA, we have so many rules about flying. You have to have so, you only can have two bags, you can't take
that's
this
the airline, not the FAA.
Okay, but there are federal rules. You got to stow your bags before takeoff. That's
yes.
an FAA rule.
Yeah.
What about a dress code in the air? When people are running around in flip-flops and slippers and pajamas, shouldn't we have a higher standard in case of an emergency? I look at this. This is not your den, you know, or your slumber party. Should we have an FAA dress code for the passengers?
You can take private air travel for that. You can wear your suit, double-piece suit for air travel. Listen, I think we have to be respectful. And it's culture, right? The culture yeah. matters. And how do we treat the people around us? Right. Do you put your feet up on the elbow rest in the seat ahead of you?
Cut your toenails, which I've seen
in
air.
There's a lot of bad practices. But that's not an airline FAA problem. That's a cultural problem. Mm-hmm. It really is. And how are we teaching our kids to be respectful of the people around us? How do we behave? How do we dress when we go out into public?
Yeah.
And so that's what you're working on, Raymond, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
Drop the hammer, Secretary. You control the airwaves. Anyway, the airwaves. Okay. You issued a statement rescinding some Biden-era policies that stipulated that any future road construction or highway construction would have to be bound by social justice and environmental concerns. First of all, why did you do that? And I know there's remaining funds that haven't been, that were already appropriated to end racist highways, which is what your predecessor called
Raymond,
of our highways.
Everybody, Democrat or Republican, they want roads and bridges. Infrastructure matters to every member of Congress, every senator. Doesn't matter their political stripe. And so I looked at, you know, what kind of rules do we have in place around building roads and bridges, building infrastructure? And there was a ton of green requirements and social justice requirements. And it drives up the cost of the projects, which means I get less roads and bridges. So if I can pull those, the green and the social justice out and focus the money on roads and bridges, that means I can build more roads and bridges across the country, which is what everybody wants. And so, again, this is just common sense. Again, we're the Department of Transportation. We're not the Green New Deal Department. We're not the Social Justice Department. We build infrastructure. So get that stuff out of these proposals and these funding mechanisms and build infrastructure.
In my city of New Orleans, we talked about this at the time. There's a Claiborne overpass that runs right through the middle of New Orleans. Your predecessor, Pete Buttigieg, declared that a racist part of the interstate system because it cut off a black community. When I went and talked to the people in that community, they said, wait a minute, that's our only conduit to the rest of the city. But the Congress appropriated $1 billion to tear that down and replace it. Are you going to follow through with that? Do you have any jurisdiction over that?
So, first of all, we're responsible for money that federal money that flows for roads and bridges comes out of this department. And again, I don't want to tear down existing roads and bridges and to put them somewhere else. Again, maybe there are some remedial efforts we can take to reconnect communities. But again, this was built 40 or 50 years ago.
50 years ago. Yes.
Right? So, I mean, how does that process work? Again, there are so many projects that we need to build.
Yeah.
Let's focus on those projects that make our lives better. I mean, how much time do people spend in traffic and congestion, right? If I get people to work faster and back home faster, you get to spend more time with your family. You might have time for a family meal together with your kids. If I get you home faster, which means I reduce congestion, which means we're investing in that infrastructure that can move people, not in this stupid stuff that the last administration focused on.
You took some heat because you came out with a memo that said we should prioritize those communities with higher marriage rates, higher population. That's where the money should go. Now, some people say, wait a minute, this is like China. Your response to that, the People's Republic of Duffy.
I did get blowback on that, but it's common sense, right? Where people get married and where people have kids is where we're going to see growth. And where you see growth, you'll need roads and bridges. This is not the only factor. This is one consideration I said we're going to look at because, again, family formation and having kids is where you'll need infrastructure. And so it would make sense. Why would anybody object to us looking at those factors?
Yeah.
Now, they made fun and said, well, maybe you're going to have to go to Las Vegas. A lot of investments in Las Vegas. There's a lot of weddings there. I'm like, hey, come on. But where those families live and where they have kids, that matters.
That's obviously where growth is going to happen. And those will be in rural areas or just outside of metropolis, Gotham areas where right now a lot of those funds are going. One of them is New York City. We give billions to the New York City Subway Authority. You have a problem with the money we're giving to New York. I know you want to look at their crime statistics. Why?
So the federal government gives millions of dollars a year to New York for their subway system, right? And one of the components that we're supposed to look at, which the last administration did not, is their crime stats, right? What do they do in regard to safety? And so if you look at the New York subway system, or go to D.C. or go to Chicago, pick any of them, but New York specifically, they're dirty. They're dangerous. People stand against the wall in the subway because they're afraid of getting shoved in front of the tracks. People are getting stabbed. It's a homeless shelter inside of the subway system in New York. It's not safe. And so why would we actually invest our federal money into a system where the politicians there don't seem to care about safety?
Well, now Hochul says she's got cops on every overnight train, New York City cops. They put state police at the stations. Do you not believe her?
I would tell you this, that right now the crime incidents are 56% higher now than it was in 2019. Mm. So crime's not going down, Raymond. Crime is going up. So maybe the effort is so great. But listen, securing a subway system, getting the homeless out, stopping the drug dealers and the people that are causing harm, it's not that hard, right? This is pretty easy stuff. Elon Musk just launched a rocket to save astronauts. That's hard. Yeah. Securing your subway system is not. And so I don't see that they've had a will to do it. And so if you don't do it, we're going to pull money. By the way, they should be responsive to the community that demands this. They want this. They shouldn't have a threat from me to hold back money. It's good government to have safe, clean trains.
It's justice for their citizens.
But if they won't do it, we'll do it for them. By the way, Raymond, they want people to ride trains. They don't like cars.
Right.
They don't want you in your car. They want you in a bus or a train. Well, if you want people to ride a bus or a train, make it clean.
The buses are packed.
Make it safe.
Because they're afraid of the subways.
Yes.
Yeah, it's really
shameful.
Bad. Speaking of trains, there are calls to privatize Amtrak. We've seen this in other countries where they've gone bust, frankly. Critics of that idea say it will reduce routes and lines and drive costs up. Do you support the privatization of Amtrak?
So this is a role for Congress. Congress has to make the decision. Do they want to make it private? Or maybe there's a cross section. You know, we keep the
hybrid.
We keep the rails in the public sector and put the trains on that are private. People can bid for those.
Yeah.
But the Congress has to make a decision, right?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of politicians who love train routes that are not financially feasible, but for taxpayer money. Again, they have to have that argument and that fight, and I'll do what they say. But right now, it is what it is. And by the way, if you look at Europe, it could be a lot better.
this is true. A lot better. There were reports of a dust-up between you and Elon Musk at that big cabinet meeting a few weeks ago. What was the context of that? Was Doge asking to cut air traffic control? Is that what it was?
Let me tell you this. Elon and I spoke after the cabinet meeting. We had a great conversation. But I'm not going to comment on the cabinet meeting. It was a private conversation.
Yeah.
And it was robust. It was a good conversation. And by the way, what Doge does is they see things that I normally wouldn't see. They see where we have redundancies. They see where they can help us look at contracts that are useless. And so to save money and make our government more efficient and effective, really
they're looking
wonderful.
At everything.
Really wonderful. They're a great tool. And then, you know, we implement what makes sense here at the department. So we've come into a really good relationship. And I commend Elon Musk for you know, willing to take time away from his businesses. But also, we've seen with the stories around Tesla that these vandals are burning these new Teslas because they disagree with cutting and making government more efficient.
And you've had, what, 400 layoffs here at at the transportation department?
There's 45,000 plus employees at the FAA. So we laid off employees who had been there for less than a year. Mm. That's 0.8% of the workforce, Raymond. They weren't safety jobs. These were not, you know, Boeing inspectors. They weren't air traffic controllers. Actually, we hired more people into those positions.
You've got a lot of missing air traffic controllers, though, right? Is that a crisis?
So we need more air traffic controllers, right? There's not enough of them. Mm-hmm. But to be clear, if we, for some reason, have four people call out sick in, you know, one of our areas, you'll see delays. You'll see cancellations. Mm. We don't fly unless it's safe, right? So, again, never think that, oh, my gosh, there's a limited number of air traffic controllers and I'm not safe in the air. Of course you are. But the key to all this, Raymond, is building a system with air traffic controllers and the best technology. It's going to reduce the congestion in the air. We're going to be more efficient in the air, which means less delays, less cancellations, and happier Americans, which is what I want, Raymond. I want you to be happy, and I want America to be happy.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Secretary.
You're welcome.
I'm happy already. Let's talk about you personally. You were here in Congress for many years. You served. You were going all the way back to Wisconsin on a couple of flights to get home. So you intimately know the hang-ups, the process, the problems of air travel today. I know you had the birth of your youngest daughter, Valentina, who has Down syndrome, and I know you and your wife, Rachel, wanted time away to kind of be together, and you'd moved to New Jersey so you could be together and care for your daughter, and it was working out fine. What happened when the president called and said, Sean, I want you to come back to D.C.? Was there any hesitation?
I talked to my family about it, right? I talked to my kids about it. And we kind of walked through what does the schedule look like? How does my time at home change with this new job?
Yeah.
On the presidential side, I knew this was going to be historic. I knew the president for 4 years has been thinking about how he can be bigger and better and even more effective in the first 4 years. And to be part of it, Raymond, has been the most amazing honor that I have ever had in my life. I work more. I do 12, 14 hours a day. And when crises, I work all day and night, but it is the best work because you know what we do? We truly do impact people's lives.
Yeah.
How people move, how fast they get home to their loved ones, how safely they travel, how quickly they get their products. Our whole economy comes through the Department of Transportation, and to be in a place that can make it better for people is remarkable. And so my kids have been incredibly supportive. And again, a lot of time on the phone, on FaceTime. Technology is really beautiful.
Yeah.
I anticipate I'm going to have more time to get home on weekends.
Yeah.
This first stretch has not been that, but I do see, you know, having some time to be able to get home or having them come down to D.C. and be with me. But we're navigating it. And by the way, public service, it's not just the individual that serves. Families serve. It's a family commitment to do these jobs, and it is an amazing honor to serve in this president's cabinet. I mean, I think he's... if not the greatest, one of the greatest presidents that have ever lived, and to be part of it is, I pinch myself sometimes.
Mm. Before I let you go, there was a viral video of you and the family praying the Hail Mary before your confirmation. How does your faith sustain you? I mean, when I see you out on the Potomac in the middle of the night, I'm like, I saw him on Fox and Friends this morning. Now he's still up at 2 a.m. in the morning. These are long, harrowing days, I know, and when you're dealing with tragedy, how does it sustain you in the midst of all this?
Listen, like you and your viewers, my faith is very important to me, and I think that when you're called to service and called in times of crisis, you don't do it by yourself. None of this happens by yourself. You know, you have someone walking with you, and it's important to tap in to your faith. I bought a place that's right near a Catholic church, and I was looking at a number of places and decided this is probably the place a half a block away from the Catholic church. But it's important. That was before the confirmation hearing. And I just thought, you know, we're gonna take this moment to say the Hail Mary before we walk in, because there's a lot of bad things that are happening.
Yeah.
There's a lot of forces that are at play, and I want to make sure I'm with the right force. I'm going to walk the right line, and that means I have to remain centered, which means I have to be focused on my faith.
Well, I wish you the best, Mr. Secretary, and
thank
we'll
you
see
much.
You soon.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
Our thanks to Secretary Duffy and his staff for making that interview possible. This week, I sat down with filmmaker John Irwin on the Arroyo Grande podcast, We talked about his new biblical series, House of David, on Amazon Prime, the hero's journey and how you can find your own hero's journey and the power of storytelling. Watch.
Is there anything you learned about David after going through this? I mean, I know you're still in it. You're immersed in this world.
It's not until you dramatize the events that you realize, oh, he never had to write any of this stuff. And the fact that he did is a huge part of what makes him relatable and great. And so it just reminds me of, like, God can use it all. And I think that that is the hero's journey.
The full Arroyo Grande interview and some fun commentary about Snow White and a few other matters can be found on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts. Each week we find life lessons and provide some cultural commentary. I think you'll enjoy it. Subscribe to Arroyo Grande so you don't miss an episode. Visit RaymondArroyo.com. The links are there. In what has become a First Amendment battle in the state of Kansas, a satanic group has scheduled a black mass outside the state capitol on March 28th. A black mass is a blasphemous inversion of the Catholic liturgy. Here to tell us more and how he and the Archdiocese of Kansas City are responding, I'm joined by Archbishop Joseph Nauman of Kansas City, Kansas. Archbishop, thank you for being here. As I mentioned, this satanic organization, they call themselves the Satanic Grotto. They're planning to go forward with this March 28th event. Can you explain to viewers what is meant by a black mass? What does it involve? I know a consecrated host is somehow a part of this. And who are these people?
Yeah, Raymond, you know, it's hard to say what a black mass truly is because they're different within satanic groups. There's different understandings of this. This group has claimed to have had a consecrated host. Now they're saying they don't. But what they want to do is they want to pray within the Capitol to Satan. And they say that they were going to defame this host, but also destroy a Bible, destroy a cross. So the whole purpose of it is really is to mock Catholicism particularly, but Christianity in general. And it's sad. Of course, we're dealing with somebody who's a disciple of the father of lies. So it's hard to understand when they're telling things that are true and what they're not true. So right now they're claiming they don't have a consecrated host.
But they told your staff they did have a host at one point, right?
Raymond, I didn't hear that exactly. But what they, we took them to court just today. And it was there that they admitted under oath that they don't have a consecrated host. So, but our response to this is to invite our people to do what Satan hates the worst, and that is to pray. We're reconsecrating the Archdiocese to Jesus through Mary. And we'll be having an hour of adoration and celebrating a mass in a church that's just across the street from the Capitol while the satanic worship is going on. I don't even like to use the term black mass because it's not a mass. It's but they're doing this to try to mock Catholic liturgy and mock Christianity in general.
Archbishop, the Kansas City Attorney General, Chris Kobach, has weighed in. He's denouncing this planned event, arguing it should not be allowed on state property as it involves the theft of and desecration of a consecrated host. But if they don't have that, Archbishop, if they now say they don't have a consecrated host, my question is, how do you defend this given the freedom of religion, and I guess that's what they'll try to couch this as, and freedom of speech?
Yeah, my belief is that they exercise hate speech. We've encountered these people recently at an outdoor rally at the Capitol for pro-life, and they tried to disrupt it, and they used all sorts of vulgarity. And there, of course, there were many families with young children present, a lot of youth present. And they, the governor has said that she will permit it. At first, she said inside the Capitol. Now she says outside the Capitol. They say they're going to storm the Capitol.
Mm.
So to me, this group is their intentions are violence. Their intentions is to create chaos, and they're exercising really hate speech. Mm. So to me, they can exercise their free speech, but why do we have to give them the Capitol or the Capitol grounds to do this? They can do that wherever they like, but they're not advocating for any kind of legislation. They're simply trying to mock Christianity. And I, you know, if they were trying to do this to an Islamic group or they were trying to do this to a Jewish group, I think it wouldn't be allowed.
Yeah.
And to me, it's fairly simple, but the governor ultimately has the decision on whether they're allowed to use these spaces or not.
Well, Archbishop, the confounding thing, we've seen this over the years with the Satanic Temple, which I guess is an affiliated group or a different group, but they kind of stage these mock religious rituals so they can invoke the freedom of exercise of religion under the Constitution, when actually they're a protest group. They're just trying to make fun of you and make fun of Christianity and test the bounds of the statute. I think that's what this is really about.
Yeah, absolutely, Raymond. And what I'm encouraging to do for people to pray that we live our own Catholic faith with greater integrity, but also to pray for conversion. These people are obviously, they're very troubled and they're very confused. And, you know, the Pope announced earlier this year the canonization of Bartolo Longo, this 19th century figure who claimed to be a satanic priest at one time, but had this tremendous conversion and eventually built a shrine to Mary in Pompeii and built orphanages and other things and had this profound, and was the inspiration to John Paul II to do the Luminous Mysteries. He had this great devotion to the rosary after he reconverted. So all things are possible with God. We're praying for the conversion of those that are very, you know, confused and disturbed. And
And Archbishop Nauman, as you mentioned, you're reconsecrating Kansas to Jesus through the Immaculate Heart of Mary on Tuesday, March 25th, during a Mass on the Solemnity of the Annunciation. You will also hold a Eucharistic Holy Hour and a Mass on the 28th at a church across the street from the Capitol building at the time this alleged Black Mass is scheduled. Tell me about those events, particularly the reconsecration, and what you want them to achieve. What are you looking for here?
Yeah, the Mass that we'll be celebrating on the Solemnity of the Annunciation already was a scheduled Mass where we were actually praying for pregnant couples. And we'll continue to do that. But at the Mass, we'll also offer this prayer of reconsecration. We're encouraging people, even if they can't come to the Mass, to make a consecration to Jesus through Mary. And by that, you know, just reclaiming our identity as beloved sons and daughters of our Heavenly Father and the worshiping the one true God revealed in Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to respond to this desecration, this mocking of our faith, by just responding in prayer and drawing ourselves closer to Jesus Christ through his mother, Mary.
Yeah. Before we run out of time, this is not the only blasphemous incident that has occurred recently or is about to occur in Kansas. On March 15th, St. Patrick's Church in Wichita was vandalized. A statue was destroyed. Candles broken. The American flag was burned. And the satanic website of this same group, the Satanic Grotto, was spray painted on a wall. This event gained national attention. Our own Owen Jensen asked President Trump about it earlier this week. Watch.
I know you signed an ego, eradicating anti-Christian bias, but sir, what more can the White House do to protect places of worship like St. Patrick's Church in Wichita, Kansas?
Well, we're going to take a look. I love Wichita. You know, I got big votes there. We won that state by a lot. We'll take a look at that. I think it's a terrible thing. And this was a Catholic church.
Yes, okay.
I'm going to take a look at it.
So the president there vowing to take a look into this incident. The Diocese of Wichita is under your jurisdiction. What have you learned regarding the incident at St. Patrick's? And what do you make of these incidents? I mean, is this a peace, Archbishop?
Yeah, it's difficult to unravel that, whether it really is the same group or another another group that's been inspired by what they're doing. But but it just is another sign that these groups, that they don't have good intent. I think they engage in violence and in hate speech. And so why would we give them a public forum to do these things? And I'm glad to hear that the president is aware of this. And I think it should be investigated as hate speech and action, violence against religious faith.
Archbishop, do you know, has the Department of Justice reached out to you at all about this case?
No, I'm not. You know, of course, that's Wichita is its own diocese. It's in my province. But I know that Bishop Kemi is paying attention to it. But at this point, I'm not certain if the Justice Department has reached out.
Before I let you go, vis-a-vis the Eucharist, I know there was this controversy about whether this group actually had stolen a Eucharist, you know, the Holy Communion during Mass. Do the relaxed rules of the reception of the Eucharist at Mass, does that make it easier for groups like this to steal and desecrate, really, the most sacred treasure of the Catholic Church?
Yeah, I mean, we've re-educated our own people about how we ought to be very careful in terms of the distribution of the Eucharist, very vigilant, that if people are going to receive in the hand, they should receive it in front of the minister, not walk away with the host in their hand. So so in that sense, yeah, I think communion in the hand makes us to try to police this. But they're also, you know, people can receive on the tongue and then take it out after they're away from the communion minister. So if they want to do this desecration of the Blessed Sacrament, I think it can happen either way. But I think we need to make our priests, our deacons, and our communion ministers very vigilant, very careful in the distribution of the Blessed Sacrament.
Archbishop Joseph Nauman, we will leave it there, and we'll keep an eye on this situation. Thank you for the time.
Thanks, Raymond. Thank you. And ask your viewers to pray for us.
Will do. Thank you. Pope Francis continues to recover from double pneumonia at the Gemelli Clinic in Rome. The Vatican issued this hospital photo to reassure the faithful. For context on this and some analysis, we go to Father Gerald Murray, canon, lawyer, and priest of the Archdiocese of New York. Father, I want to start with this photo. It's the first time we've seen the Pope in over a month. The photo was released on March 16th. As you can see, it shows the Pope seated in a wheelchair before an altar at the hospital's private chapel. Francis is here wearing a purple stole and what appears to be a white cassock. What are your thoughts on what we're really seeing?
Well, I'm happy to see the Pope, and you can see part of his face and certainly the back of his head. But number one, that's strange. Why wouldn't they have a face, complete face picture?
Right.
Secondly, you look at what's the alb, which is what you wear when you have and celebrating Mass and you have a stole over, but you know, on closer examination, that's really a hospital sheet.
Right.
That's not an alb, and that's you know, irregular to say the least. And you don't celebrate Mass wearing a hospital sheet. Now, granted, he's in the hospital, but if they have a stole, they could have brought an alb. So I think, you know, that's not very edifying, and it explains why the photo's not from the front, because you'd see the sheet.
Right.
So that's regrettable. I wish they had taken the extra effort.
And on the left-hand side of the image, you can see the excess folds of that sheet. Also this week, the Pope seemed to be well enough to pen a letter to the editor of an Italian daily, writing that his convalescence has made him more aware of the absurdity of war. So he's writing these letters. They've also announced that he's going to be visiting with Prince Charles at the top of April. And Cardinal Pietro Parolin, the Secretary of State, said there is no possibility that the Pope is going to resign. It's not going to happen. On the one hand, his ill health prevents him from celebrating mass and leaving the hospital. On the other, he's writing letters to the editor and planning royal visits. Your reaction to this posture?
Well, I think this is where the Vatican's got to get their message a little clearer to the people, what's going on here. The Pope is obviously recovering slowly because he's up sitting in chair, he's getting photographed, he's communicating with people. But what's the plan here? Is the Pope going to be going back to Santa Marta, the residence where he lives on Vatican City state grounds? Mm-hmm. How long he's going to be in the hospital? Is it realistic to him have him visiting with the King of England in a couple of weeks? So it would be good. And then as regards to resignation, the Pope himself has said if he was debilitated, he said that at the beginning of the pontificate, that he would resign.
Right.
So, you know, Cardinal Parolin, I think, wants to basically damp down the media fury, but it's up to the Pope if he wants to resign, and, you know, let's see what happens. But certainly they need a media strategy that's a little better than what they've had so far.
Yeah, well, I got to say, it looks like it's full steam ahead to my eye, Father. In fact, it was announced that a synod on synodality, it's becoming its own perpetual franchise. Cardinal Grech announced that the Pope has approved a new, get this, 3-year synodal implementation process, which will culminate in an episcopal assembly in 2028. Your reaction? I know you have one to this.
Yes. No, actually, it's not an episcopal assembly. It's an ecclesial assembly.
An ecclesial
assembly.
They changed
the terminology.
Uh-huh.
And they said, basically, they're canceling the planned synod 3 years from now. There will be no synodal meeting. There'll be an ecclesial assembly, and it will not be substantially populated by bishops, as opposed to the synod and bishops that we just finished last fall. So I don't know what an ecclesial assembly is. Cardinal Grech said it's something new on the level of universal church. No details about who's going to be there, who gets invited, how many lay people, how many bishops, how many cardinals. It's all a mess, in my opinion, because you announce something without defining what it really is.
Yeah, but tell people how important this is, because if you populate this with laymen, this disturbs the entire nature of the Catholic Church, Father.
Yes, I wrote an article in Today's Catholic Thing about it. An ecclesial assembly is a creation of the people in the synod office. It's not, there's no history in the Catholic Church of substituting a synod of bishops with a meeting made up of who knows what percentage of lay people and others. In the Catholic Church, the shepherds are over the flock. The flock is not over the shepherds. And by the way, since this is replacing a synod, it's being given an equivalent value thereby. And the value of the synod, of course, is to issue or help the Pope by issuing a document that will help him govern the church. So we don't need lay people gathering in Rome in a big assembly and then issuing a document and basically telling the world's episcopate and the Pope, this is what we want. Mm-hmm. I see this subject to manipulation by pressure groups. I think this will be the ideal occasion for those who want ordination of women and the legitimization of homosexuality to come forward and say, the people demand this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, wait a minute. The people don't run the Catholic Church. The Pope and the bishops do. And by the way, the one who really runs the Catholic Church is Jesus Christ. We're his representatives on earth, the ordained clergy. So this is a mess. I hope the bishops and cardinals rise up and say, we can't do this. You don't start something with no knowledge of what it is.
Yeah.
But that's what's happening.
I want to get to an odd story. This is out of the Klagenfurt Diocese in Austria. An Episcopal vicaress, we've never had one of these, Barbara Velik Frank, has apparently been in charge of a Catholic parish since March 1st. She's a proponent of the ordination of women. And the title of vicar, that title has always been canonically reserved, Father, for priests, as you know. But the local bishop, Joseph Marketz, has openly stated that he's created a new extra-canonical title for this lady. And he's calling her, here's the official title, the Vicaress of Synodality and Church Development. Your reaction to this and the canonical implications.
Yeah, this is canonically null. There is no such thing as a female vicaress for synodality and whatever else. Women cannot run parishes. She's dressed up in an alb and a pseudo stole. It's ridiculous that the bishop would do this, but it's even beyond that. It's an attack on the nature of the church. In the Catholic Church, the priest represents Jesus Christ. And therefore, the parish is under a priest who is the spiritual father of that church and of those parishioners. Mm. The bishop has no right to do this. He should be ashamed of himself because he's attacking Catholic doctrine through these symbolic, we could say, street theater performances. And by the way, if the woman believes in the ordination of women to the priesthood, then she's embracing a heretical notion. The church has determined there is no power on the part of the church to ordain a woman a priest. And if somebody attempts to do it, a bishop who is deranged or whatever, the person who's ordained, so-called ordained, and the bishop are excommunicated. So this is a serious matter. You don't play around with Christ's sacrament. That's what this bishop is doing.
In a related story, a bishop in Switzerland, Markus Buchel, says he wants to begin ordaining women to combat the priest shortage, Father. He says it's an emergency. And my question is this. There appears to be a movement underway in Europe. There was a carnival in Viareggio, Italy, where a massive float featured a popus, a female pope, flanked by the cupola and white smoke. Now, look, this is pop culture. I get it. But some in the church hierarchy seem to be syncing up with the world here on female ordination. Your thought?
Yeah, no, this bishop in Switzerland, this is Christian charity in its height. Bishop, you are attacking the nature of the church that you are shepherding. The doctrine of the faith is not a human creation you can cast aside. It's not a political platform. When you attack the doctrine and say women should be ordained and I want to do it, you're betraying your mission. What he should do is repent and return to the faith. And if he can't do that, he should resign. Because he cannot accurately, truly represent the doctrine that he's commanded to teach if he denies that doctrine in public.
Before we go, Ed Penton broke a story about Libero Meloni. He was the lawsuit that he filed against the Vatican for unlawful dismissal. A Vatican tribunal has ordered key parts of his suit removed from Meloni's appeal. He was running the Vatican, overseeing the Vatican finances. Those parts that they want dismissed, Father, have to do with the documented allegations of financial malfeasance, corruption, and obstruction of justice by Vatican officials. You'll recall he was the chief auditor reviewing the Vatican finances from about 2015 to 2017. How can Meloni and his attorneys, Father, proceed in his defense, given the key parts of that defense seem to have been removed now?
Yeah, this is quite shocking that a court in entertaining a lawsuit by a person who alleges that he's been offended by the authority that he's suing, is then told the evidence upon which you base your complaint is inadmissible, not because it's been judged and proven to be false, but simply because they say it's defamatory and things of this sort. This is absurd in a modern legal system. The weight of the evidence is based upon the nature of what's presented. And in this case, documentary evidence supporting allegations that the reason he was fired is that he uncovered and revealed this kind of thing happening. And therefore, if he was fired, he was fired unjustly based on the fact that he brought evidence to the authorities' attention. This is not how you operate a system of law. This is very bad. I'm not... I speak as an observer reading the papers. I haven't seen all the evidence, but certainly what I see here, I can't believe that the Vatican thinks that this is a just way of acting, denying a man a right to make his allegations based on documents, written documents. That's it. It is not simply verbal allegations.
Father Jerry, we will leave it there, and we'll check in with you soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Raymond.
He's a comic actor, a master impressionist, star of numerous classic comedy films, not to mention an early 80s cast member of Saturday Night Live when it was really Saturday Night Live. He's also author of a new memoir, packed with behind-the-scenes stories about his incredible life in showbiz and beyond, Average Joe, The Memoirs of a Blue-Collar Entertainer. Please welcome my pal, the vice chairman of the board, Mr. Joe Piscopo. Joe, thank you for being here. I'm delighted. Tell us how you got into this business, Joe, and who your first inspirations are. I thought it would be Sid Caesar or Milton Berle or somebody, but it wasn't.
Yeah, very close. And Raymond, honored to be with you always. Sure. Really, really always an honor to be with you, dear friend. And thanks for reading the book. I appreciate that very much. But, you know, the funny thing is, when I was a kid in Bloomfield, New Jersey, and we'd be watching the Ed Sullivan Show, And I just can distinctly remember, third grade maybe I was, and there was a guy, and this is really esoteric.
Okay.
So stay with me if you would. There was a guy named Guy Marks, and he was a comedian out of Philadelphia. And he would do like bits. And also a guy named Frank Gorshin. These guys would do bits. They would set stages and say, what happens if this guy, if Humphrey Bogart, walks into a bar? I was mesmerized by that. Jerry Lewis was always my icon, and you doing the greatest Jerry Lewis interview ever. You know, that's show business legend. We all know that. So Jerry was like a hero to me watching The Nutty Professor back then.
Yeah.
But these guys and Ed Sullivan doing characterizations, that caught my eye. Not the Alan Kings, not the Milton Berles, not the stand-ups, the guys that would just do characterization. Isn't that funny? I got sucked right into that.
Yeah, and they were kind of Frank Gorshin was a renowned impressionist. Of course, people know him from the Riddler on the old Batman show, but he was much more than that if you've ever seen his act, you know. But you say you weren't a comic, Joe Piscopo, but why were you in comedy class?
Yeah. Well, just to get a platform to become a working actor. So when I went and I got out of college, and my father, God bless him, rest his soul, was an attorney, and I knew I should have gone to law school. He could have probably got me into law school, and I would have been with him in Jersey representing, you know, the blue-collar workers like Pop did. And I said, let me try the comedy thing, because, Ray, I didn't want to, like, get to an age and say, geez, I wonder what would have happened if I ever did that. So I said, I got to go to the comedy clubs. Let me get on stage. They could see me. And then all I wanted to be is what I am now, just a working actor. Are you working? It's about working. It's about the journey. Never wanted to be a star. Never wanted to be a stand-up comic. So I went, I put like 5 minutes together, went to the improvisation, 1976. When New York was really rough. You think it's bad now. It was really rough back then. And the story goes, as I said in the book, it was true. I said, let me try audition night, Sunday nights. And I went in, and I went through the Lincoln Tunnel and went around 8th Avenue, came down 9th Avenue, 44th and 9th, the legendary improvisation comedy club. Audition night, there must have been 300, maybe 400 people waiting to get into audition.
400?
And I looked at I had to be hundreds of people lined down 9th Avenue. Right. And I looked at that line and I kept going, went right back in the Lincoln Tunnel, and I went back home and chickened out completely, you know.
Tell me how Ann Mira and Jerry Stiller mentored you. You mentioned that in the book.
Oh, the best. I just saw Ben Stiller, and I just told him how Ann and Jerry were such a big influence on me. So after a while, when I went back, I would go, we would have to get there at noon to audition. And then at 8 o'clock, I remember everybody, Judy would come out, she'd hand the numbers out, and we'd get on stage. So you do audition after a while. And then Chris Albrecht, as you read in the book, was the guy that made me a regular at the improv. Meant you had to hang out in the dark, dingy bar till 2:30 in the morning and play before like four drug people. That was a regular, you know? But who was in the bar? It was Stiller and Mira. It was Ann and Jerry, and they were there, and they could not have been nicer. They were just so kind to me, and they said, "Look, you gotta work." And then they said to me, and they said, "You gotta do the commercials." I said, "I could do commercials? Yes. Somebody will come in. They'll see you on stage. You'll be able to do commercials and make money, and that's the money. So if you make money doing commercials, you can really do what you want to do in your career." And they were really influential. Could not have been nicer. We were scared. We were all scared back then.
Yeah, of course.
And Ann Mira particularly was so nice. They were sweetheart. They gave me the best advice. You want to do commercials, you'll make money, so you could go like this. You remember this, the Italian thing?
Yeah.
You could do what you want.
Yeah, and Larry David was also a comic at the same time and a writer. Was he on SNL when you were there?
He was for a minute. And he was like, let me tell you, back in the late 70s, at the comedy scene, and thank you for bringing it up, Ray, the comedy scene, it was like when comedy became rock and roll.
Right.
It just caught on. I don't know if it was Freddie Prinze Sr., whether it was Rodney, whether it was Robin Williams, Robert Klein. I wonder whatever it was a perfect mix of, oh, my gosh, comedy is hot. Everybody had to do comedy. And so that's when I went in there, and there was Larry David. Larry David was there. And Larry had been there a couple of years prior to when I went in.
Yeah.
So now Larry was, he would go on stage, and he would get into, like, fights with the audience. Right. He would get into the back. What you see on Curb Your Enthusiasm, yeah, that's Larry, man.
Yeah.
He'd be going. And we would all gather by the little hallway that led to the showroom, the bar to the showroom. Hey, yeah. Larry's on. Larry's on. And you go, and Larry, back and forth with the people, fighting with the people. And it was, you know what, though? It was comic genius. You could see it was comic genius, you know? But I've never seen him do a full set because he would always leave in a huff. It was so great to watch. Back then, you know.
He'd leave in a huff. Yeah, look, we have mutual friends, and he continues that routine today, Joe. But look, tell me, leaves in a huff. Tell me what you learned when I read in the book about Rodney Dangerfield. He was the first comic I ever saw live. I was 11 years old, and I begged my mother to buy tickets to two of his shows back-to-back in New Orleans. And I sat in the front row. He insulted me for half of it. It was fantastic. What did you learn from Rodney Dangerfield?
Well, Rodney was a sweetheart, and he would come in, and I was the MC at that point.
Right.
And so I'd be on the stage at the Improv, and you could see the shadow of Rodney in the back light, in the back room, and I'll never forget this. And Rodney, I'll tell you, sweetheart, great guy, and blew that room out like nobody else. Rodney killed it. Pryor came into that room. All the greats came into that room. Nobody blew that room out, the improvisation, 44th and 9th, Hell's Kitchen in New York, late 70s, like Rodney.
Joe, I can't thank you enough for being here. And the book, Average Joe, The Memoirs of a Blue-Collar Entertainer by Joe Piscopo, is available at bookstores everywhere. Thank you, my friend. We'll talk soon. And you all can stay tuned for the next part of this interview next week. Thank you. That is all the time we have for this week. Be sure to catch us next week. Dallas Jenkins talks season 5 of The Chosen and part 2 of my interview with Joe Piscopo. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.